Thanks so much, Jess. Can I add my welcome to James's? My name's Andrew. I'm one of the pastors here. And do keep open that passage. We're going to be looking at Genesis 16. It's on page 11, or it's also on the inside of your service sheet, and that's got some headings that we're going to be looking at together. I wanted to begin with the question to ask you what you're like at waiting for things. Are you the kind of person for whom perhaps fasting for days on end, you know, it's just effortless, you just draw on your inner strength? Or is fasting between mouthfuls the kind of full extent of your capacity to wait patiently? I guess we all know, don't we, waiting is really difficult. We all find it difficult. Perhaps we are waiting for a break at work, or we're waiting for work at all. Or perhaps we are waiting for a romantic relationship, or for marriage. Perhaps we're waiting for some painful issue in our marriage to be resolved. Or we're waiting for children. Or we're waiting for the resolution of some health issue just rumbling on in our lives. Or we're waiting for a loved one to share our faith. And I guess for those of us in the room who are believers, that won't be all of us, whether online or in person. For those of us who are believers, sometimes this waiting can be even harder because we know that God could fix this like that if he wanted to, and yet he hasn't. You know, we may have prayed about it, and yet God has left us waiting, and we think, does God even care about our situation? What about when waiting seems too hard? That's the question we're thinking about, and especially when it's hard because God doesn't seem to be delivering. That was actually the situation that our passage began with. You probably noticed Sarai in our passage. We're going to think about her situation, her struggle with waiting in a moment. But before we get into our passage, let's just reorient ourselves. If you're here with us through the autumn, that was when we started this series in Abraham, our father in the faith. And if you've been with us in the autumn, which won't be all of us, you'll remember that Abraham was this ordinary guy, and yet the Lord gave him some extraordinary promises. And God told him to leave everything behind, his security, his homeland, his family, and he was to go with his wife Sarai. And God promised that he'd make him into a great nation, give him a beautiful land, and that ultimately his family, his offspring, would be the means through which God would bring blessing, salvation really, to the whole world. So we're right at the beginning of the Bible, but this is the gospel in embryo, promised hundreds of years in advance here in Abraham's life. And these are incredible, wonderful promises, but, and this is where, as we pick up our story in Genesis 16, since God made these promises, there really hasn't been a whole load of progress. In fact, the land that God promised hasn't yet materialized. Abram and Sarai still living in tents. And most significantly in our passage, the offspring, the child, hasn't yet materialized either. So put yourself in Sarai's sandals. It was hard enough for Sarai to believe God's promise when he made it. She was 65 years old then, and she didn't have any children. She was barren. But verse 3 tells us she's now been living in the land for 10 long years. So 10 plus years and nothing to show for it. And she's finding it hard. She's struggling. Incidentally, for those who like to know the big picture where we are in the book, structure-wise, chapters 12 to 15 are more concerned with the land promise. And our chapter 16 right through to 22, these chapters are more concerned with the offspring, child promise. So let's get into the passage, and the first thing we see in the first half of the passage is how, this is first heading, impatient distrust spirals down into a chaotic mess, and we're going to think about that together. So let's look at verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. There's the brute fact, the problem, and here's the response. Sarai had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." So what Sarai is suggesting here, you know, send the maid in to get pregnant, and then, you know, then she's going to bring up the maid's child as her own child. It was a kind of ancient surrogacy arrangement. It was actually pretty ordinary behavior in the culture at the time. As we go through Genesis, we're going to see it again in chapter 30 with Rachel and then with Leah and their servants. But whilst it was very ordinary and acceptable in that culture, as readers of Genesis, we know it was not in line with God's purposes. God's blueprint for marriage was given to humanity back in Genesis 2, and marriage was always given to be a faithful and exclusive relationship. The marriage bed was always to be kept pure, no one else involved. So polygamy does happen in the Old Testament, but wherever it crops up, it is always critiqued. It's always shown, as it is here, to be dysfunctional, and it is not God's ideal. And we get a sense of the writer Moses' sadness about what is happening here in the extra kind of redundant phrases. Look at verse 3. So, after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, it's an interesting detail. We already know, don't we, who Sarai is. But you see, it's being rubbed in our faces here. The one who is doing this, Moses wants to let us know, is Sarai's wife. The one who's doing this is the woman who is irreversibly and exclusively bound to him in a one flesh union. We can almost sense Moses kind of face palming as he, you know, writes this and retells the story. This woman is Abram's wife. And yet, verse 3, she took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram. Full stop. No, it's not full stop. Which Abram is it? Oh yeah, Abram, her husband. Thanks, Moses. We weren't quite sure which Abram you were talking about, but we've got that now. Do you see that what's being rubbed home here, that their marriage relationship? And what was the nature of this gift? Well, let's keep going. Oh yeah, Hagar was given to Abram as a wife. It's just being rubbed home to us. Actually, as a wife is a bit more than Sarai had intended, isn't it? Sarai didn't want Hagar to be a wife to Abram. She just wanted her to be a convenient receptacle to gestate a child for her, an object. But as we're going to see, when we mess with God's purposes, often things don't work out quite as neatly as planned. And for us, there are lots of things, equivalent things, which are kind of respectable, acceptable in our culture, but which are just not acceptable to God. There are various examples we could pick on, and I was thinking one obvious one would be cohabitation. Like, I'm aware that this is a very sensitive one to bring up in 21st century London. It's so normal. But that's the point here in Genesis 16, the distinction, isn't it, between what is mainstream and ordinary and what is actually God's ideal for human flourishing. Back in 2011, Prince William and Kate were commended in the media. They were even commended by the Archbishop of York at the time, John Sentamu, for being sensible enough to cohabit before they got married, to check that they were compatible, as the argument goes. But quite apart from the fact that all the evidence shows that the chance of divorce goes up by a massive one-third for those who cohabit before marriage, the key problem is, of course, that it's against God's purpose for sex and for marriage. Sex is a wonderful gift of God, created by him, and yet it was always intended to be enjoyed within the safety, within the commitment of a covenant relationship and nowhere else. And so for Christians, what the culture thinks about something is not to be the deciding factor for what we do. And so can I encourage you, if you're in that situation, I know many of us will be, we're in London, it's the 21st century, but please come and talk about it. Or we're going to have a seminar called Sex, Dating and Relationships next month in February. We're going to talk about why this is God's ideal. So we're not trying to condemn anyone. It's just that we know that God's ways are always for our blessing. This is one of the issues that lots of us have to confront if we're keen to acknowledge Jesus' lordship in our lives. And we're not trying to pick on anyone. In fact, if you've been at Grace Church any time at all, you'll know that God's word is always treading on our toes. It'll be a different thing each week. And actually, all of us are needing to repent. All of us are repenting of all kinds of things all the time. Now, in the way this passage is written, we're meant to notice as we read it lots of parallels with Adam and Eve's sin earlier in Genesis, in the Garden of Eden. And we're going to spot five now. You might spot more as we read, but here are five I noticed. There's a deliberate language link. So just as Eve took of the fruit and gave some to her husband, here in our passage, Sarai took Hagar and gave Hagar to her husband. There's another deliberate language link in verse 2. Abram is described as passively listening to the voice of his wife in verse 2. Just as Adam is criticized by God for doing exactly that back in chapter 3:17. Incidentally, husbands, it's often a very good thing to listen to your wife. In fact, God says as much to Abram in a few chapters' time in chapter 21, do whatever Sarah tells you to. But the point here is that if our wives are driven by discontent and unbelief, as Eve was, and in fact as Sarai is in this passage, then to listen to them, to take the path of least resistance, which is what Adam does and what Abram does, that is not to love our wives at all. That is actually to forsake our calling as husbands. And it was that weak passivity from Adam which plunged this whole world into misery. And also, just like chapter 3, the sin here is immediately followed by all the normal reflexes. So there's blaming, there's self-righteousness, there's the claiming of victimhood. I mean, I don't need to tell you about this. We are experts at this, aren't we? It's so boringly predictable. We all do it. It wasn't me, it was the woman you put here with me. That was Adam's attempt. It wasn't me, it was the serpent's fault. That was Eve's attempt. Or here in verse 5, Sarai basically says, this is all your fault, Abram. I'm the victim here. And just like in the garden, the sin then just snowballs and it spreads into more and more and more sin and then more and more chaos and misery. So that by verse 6, Sarai is so angry, she's so incensed by the way Hagar is now looking down on her now that Hagar's got pregnant, that Sarai actually feels justified in persecuting Hagar. And she treats her so cruelly that Hagar ends up running for her life out into the desert, rather than tolerating Sarai's treatment for another moment. It's really a serious low point for the people of God here. So every Israelite was brought up knowing the story about the slaves. Do you know the one about the slaves who were treated harshly by their Egyptian masters and they escaped into the desert? This is what we're going to be studying later in the term in our grace groups on Wednesdays, the story of the Exodus. But here, it's the other way round. It's flipped. It's perverted. Sarai is playing the Pharaoh figure. She's the oppressor. And she is forcing the Egyptian slave to escape into the desert. And we should feel the shock of it. This is the opposite of the way things should have been. And sadly, we may see this kind of dynamic in churches ourselves. Sadly, sometimes the people of God can be more part of the problem than part of the solution in this world. And tragically, the church can become a place of abuse rather than a place of refuge as it should be. And that is exactly what Hagar discovers here. And the Bible's very realistic about this. It's not so that we shrug and we think, well, that's fine, but say that we're not naive. So that we're quick to own our sin where necessary and turn from it. And hopefully we can develop good structures which are one part of our defense against this because we're realists. So this passage, like Genesis 3, reveals how easily sin spreads in our lives, just snowballs. And of course, this is the truth which our enemy is continually lying to us about, isn't it? You will not surely die, as the serpent said in the garden. It's just a little sin, after all. There won't be real consequences. And it's a lie, because sin always has consequences. Even those little sins which we convince ourselves are harmless or victimless. You know, sins like greed or harboring resentment or viewing pornography. And incidentally, many of these sins are not as victimless as we like to think they are. But even in the effect these sins have on ourselves, they are never harmless. Every time we sin, we rewire our thinking. We set up habits that end up controlling us, habits of mind, habits of behavior. And like Sarai here, what begins as discontent, what begins as just that little compromise, everyone does it in our culture, it then opens up the floodgates for all kinds of other destructive behaviors, which at the beginning, I guess Sarai would have thought she was never even capable of, but it gets out of control. It's like the Lord warns Cain in chapter 4. Sin is crouching at the door. It's like a ferocious animal. It desires to devour us. It's stronger than us. And we are not to play with it, let alone feed it and make it strong. We're not to mess around with this. So there are all these parallels here, aren't there, with Adam and Eve's sin. But I think perhaps the most revealing parallel, I think, is what triggers the downfall in both these scenarios. So think about it. What was it? I mean, neither Sarai nor Eve, neither of them woke up that morning thinking, what can I do to stick two fingers up at God? What can I do to, you know, release chaos and misery into my life and into the world? What happened was, the only thing that happened was this. They started to distrust the Lord. They just started to distrust that the Lord was good. And that root of discontent, that root of doubt started to grip them. So do you remember Eve's temptation? Maybe the serpent's right. Maybe God is a spoil sport. Maybe he's trying to hold something back from me which would be good for me. Perhaps God doesn't really love me. Perhaps he can't be trusted. And we sense that same kind of murmuring from Sarai's heart in this passage in verse 2. Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go to my servant. And we can hear the tone of that statement. God's not keeping his part of the bargain. He can't be trusted. He's holding something back from me which is good and which I need. So of course I'm going to have to grab it myself. The Lord hasn't provided the income I need. So I'm going to have to overwork and neglect church. The Lord hasn't provided the spouse I need. So I'm going to have to date a non-Christian. And so on. All those little grubby shortcuts. And they all stem from just not trusting the Lord, not knowing that he's good. And can I say just how transforming this discovery is for living the Christian life? To discover that the sin behind the sin is always the same. It's always refusing to trust the Lord. So actually, before I disobey any command, it's always because I've bought into the same old lie that God is withholding something good and that to get that good thing, I need to ignore God and to grab it myself. And therefore, the real battle every day of our lives is the same. The battle is to be so full of joy in the Lord, to be captivated by God and his goodness and his sufficiency, that of course, it's obvious I want to trust him. He gives me everything I need. And as we start to believe that day by day, then the tempter's lies start to lose their traction. There's no credibility to them. And that's why for believers, regular visits to the Lord in prayer and in meditation on his word is so vital. It's our lifeline for living the Christian life. And especially not just kind of seeing Bible reading or prayer as something we tick off. It's a duty on our to-do list. But especially coming to the Lord to commune with him, being refreshed in our joy in him and our thankfulness to him. That is what we need, not just daily, but all through the day. Now, I remember having this lesson brought home to me a couple of decades ago in a sermon from a guy called Rico Tice, who's a minister here in London. And that talk really stuck with me. So Rico was having all kinds of struggles in his life, and he went to an older Christian man, an Australian called Chapo, to try and get some advice, what should he do? And after Rico had explained all his problems, and there were problems that he was having at work, problems he was having in his love life, problems he was having battling sin, problems he was having with his family, and out it all came. And this older guy, Chapo, he listened to it all, he kind of absorbed it, and then he asked Rico one question. Rico, how's your thank life? He was an Australian. And what this older guy, Chapo, had discerned correctly was that behind all of these presenting problems, the real problem was a lack of joy in the Lord, a lack of thankfulness to the Lord. There was no practice of thankfulness. And I think we see that dynamic in this passage, don't we? Sarai, she's transfixed on what she thinks the problem is. She needs to fix that childlessness by whatever means possible. It's actually not what she needs. What she really needs is to refocus. She needs to retune her heart to God's kindness and to discover what kind of a Lord she serves. Lord, it is hard waiting. I'm finding it painful. It is not obvious to me, Lord, why you're not answering my prayers. But one thing I do know is that you are always good. I'm so thankful for all your goodness to me, listing his thankfulness. And so whatever is going on, Lord, help me to trust you and to keep clinging to you through this waiting. So we've been thinking about the first half of this passage and the picture it gives us of how, this was point one, wasn't it? Impatient distrust spirals down into more and more sin and chaos and mess. And the second half of this passage, and this is just the tonic we need, it's quite a heavy first half, and it's a tonic because it shows us how despite the mess that we create by our sin, this is point two, the Lord works in the mess to reveal his kindness. Actually, we're going to see his kindness is shown to all kinds of people in the second half of the passage. It's to Abram, to Sarai, to Ishmael. But the special focus of this chapter is the Lord's kindness to this woman, Hagar. And we're going to spend nearly all the time on that. So let's pick up the story from verse 7. The angel of the Lord found Hagar by a spring of water in the wilderness, the spring on the way to Shur, and he said, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? There's maybe a little echo here of Adam, where are you? Back in chapter 3. And this is a very poignant and touching moment. And to feel the wonder of it, we need to really remember who it is that the Lord is addressing here through his angel. We learned in chapter 12 that Abram was given Egyptian servants when he visited Pharaoh. And we presume that's when Hagar came into Sarai's service as her maid. So Hagar's lived nearly all her life in Egypt, and we assume that she worships Egyptian gods. And it's worth saying that despite being treated terribly herself, Hagar is not at all guiltless in this affair. In verse 4, she did look down her nose at childless Sarai. She gloated over another woman's childlessness. It's a very cruel thing to do. And Hagar is not crying out to the Lord here or anything like that. She's not really seeking God. And yet even so, the Lord in his kindness, he goes after her. He pursues her. Hagar, verse 8. This is actually the only time God addresses a woman by name in the whole Old Testament. Just think about that. Not Leah or Deborah or Ruth or Esther. None of them get this kind of tender treatment that we discover here for Hagar. Hagar. And we get something of the Lord's concern for the outsider, whoever they may be. We saw this in the theme verse, didn't we? The Lord is good to all. His mercy is over all that he has made. And that is especially the case when, like Hagar, they're afflicted and they're downtrodden. So, verse 8, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from? Where are you going? She said, I'm fleeing from my mistress, Sarai. The angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit to her. It's actually a hard thing that the Lord is asking of Hagar here. And I guess this is partly the Lord's kindness to Abram. Hagar's son Ishmael is Abram's son as well. And this passage ends in verse 15 by underlining this. Hagar bore Abram a son. And as we're going to see in the next chapter, Ishmael is going to be a much loved son by his father. And the Lord purposes that some of his blessing to Abram is going to overflow to this child, Ishmael. So being in Abram's household is therefore the key to Ishmael receiving this incredible blessing from the Lord. Let's look at that blessing, verse 10. The angel of the Lord said to her, I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. They're going to become a great nation. And the angel of the Lord said to her, 11, behold, you are pregnant. You shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. And that name Ishmael means that God hears. Every time Hagar calls her son's name for the decades to follow, she's going to be reminded of how kind the Lord is in hearing her affliction. Verse 12, he will be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone, everyone's hand against him. He shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. So yes, Hagar's wife, life has been characterized by servitude. That's all she's known. But her son's life is going to be characterized by independence. In fact, if anything, he's going to be uber independent, like a wild donkey. And Hagar acknowledges the extraordinary kindness that she is being shown here. Verse 13. So she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, you're a God of seeing. For she said, truly here I have seen him who literally sees or looks after me. And there's a deliberate kind of double meaning in this title that Hagar gives to the Lord. Lord, you are a seeable God because you reveal yourself. And Lord, you are a seeing God because you see and care for the likes of me. And in both these senses, you're a God of seeing and you're marvelous. Here is the God who intervenes to reveal himself to those who aren't even seeking for him. Here's the God who sees and knows and cares for the unlikely and the unworthy. Here's the God whose mercy is over all that he has made. These are beautiful verses. And I think these verses should be a challenge to us and a comfort. And they're a challenge because, well, there's a temptation for us as Christians to think God's concern is for his people. And that's it, full stop. God loves his church, of course. But, you know, the godless, the rebellious, the heathen out there, well, I don't suppose God even gives them much thought. And although hopefully we don't express it this way, hopefully, when we come across people whose worldviews and behaviours are just miles away from our own, perhaps just inside we're inwardly tutting and shaking our heads. And we're thinking, well, I'll be civil, but really I can't wait to retreat as quickly as possible back to the ghetto where I can get back with all the people like me, all the straight-laced, respectable people, we think. And actually, when we think like that, we show we have much more in common with the Pharisees in Jesus' day than with Jesus. If you've read the gospel accounts, you'll know that Jesus' heart was always brimming with compassion for all the wrong kinds of people. He loved the people with the alternative lifestyles, the alternative attitudes, the people who were often feeling judged by all the starchy religious folk. And that's why the Pharisees just couldn't cope with Jesus. Because Jesus is the same God as here in Genesis 16. He's the God who goes after the Hagars, the God who goes after the Rahabs and all the other undesirables through the Bible. And so this passage should challenge us as to whether our heart really is like God's heart. But of course, the verses should also be an incredible comfort, as they have been to me this week. And they're a comfort to us if we are a Hagar, if we're someone who's a total outsider, spiritually speaking. Perhaps we're not even searching. In fact, some of us, like Hagar, have seen the ugliness of how God's people can behave, and we're literally trying to run in the opposite direction. If this is what church is like, I'm having nothing to do with it. And here we discover that despite all that, God is still pursuing us. In fact, he feels just as incensed about the way we've been treated as we do, actually more so. And he sees, and he knows, and he cares. And he longs for us to come home, hard as that will be. These verses are also an incredible comfort to us if we're a Sarai. And what I mean is this. Sarai, in this passage, she has acted appallingly. She's been discontent. She's been impatient. She's led others into sin. She's been self-righteous. She's even been abusive. And yet we discover God is not finished with her. And there's no question that Sarai's life is going to be a lot messier from here on in. She's going to have to live every day watching someone else bring up Abram's beloved son in her own house. And there's going to be a lot of conflict and pain ahead. But the Lord's plans for Sarai have not been derailed by one inch. The Lord still has wonderful blessing in store for her, as we're going to see. And the Lord still has an incredible work to do in her. She's going to be celebrated as one of the heroes of faith by the time we get to the New Testament. And the reason this is such a comfort for you and me is because so often in church, we're used to the testimony in church, which goes like this. Well, before I was a Christian, I was living this terrible life. And we paint it in Technicolor. But thankfully, Jesus intervened. He saved me and he cleaned me up. Full stop. We stop the testimony there. That's the kind of Saul of Tarsus becoming the Apostle Paul testimony. And yet the reality is, for many of us, it is much more messy than that. And the Bible is so realistic that sometimes our great failures are not pre-conversion, but like Sarai in this passage, very often they're much more recent. In fact, we might be in the midst of one right now. And so what a comfort it is to see that the Lord is not thrown by our failures and our sin. He's not surprised by them. He's not thwarted by them. In fact, we see in this passage, the Lord is a specialist in coming to us in the midst of our mess and showing his wonderful kindness. You see, Genesis reminds us that God's grace doesn't dry up when we're undeserving. Of course, if it did, it wouldn't be grace. That's the point of grace. God's kindness comes to us in our mess, not after we've cleaned it up. And that makes all the difference. What a relief. Sometimes we get this idea, don't we, that God's purposes for us are like a tightrope. And once we've slipped off the tightrope, well, that's it. We're always going to be second division Christians. We'll be just scraping through, never one of the proper ones, the shiny ones. And yet the story of Abram and Sarai reminds us that though there are going to be some serious bumps on the way, very likely, and we may make some serious mess in our lives, wonderfully, the Lord is committed to us. He will get us to the end of the race, and it will be worth it. We began by thinking, didn't we, that question, how to respond when waiting is hard. It is hard. This is actually a situation I think all of us face in various ways. You might think about it in your own life. And actually, the more we are grounded in the Lord's grace and in his love, the more we discover and rest in the Lord of Genesis 16, the Lord who works in the mess to reveal his kindness, the more we will be able then to keep trusting, even when it's painful, even when God doesn't seem to be delivering. And the more actually we would then be empowered to avoid those grubby shortcuts like Sarah did. And instead we'll be empowered to follow the example of our Saviour. The Lord Jesus, who kept throughout his life waiting well, entrusting himself to the one who's going to sort out the mess at the end, the one who will lift him up in due time. I'm going to leave a little quiet now. I've put some questions actually on the inside of the sheet which might be helpful for you as you reflect. But why not come to the Lord in the quietness and consciously resolve to trust him? And then we'll have our prayers.